Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of All Things Policy. My name is Kripa Koshi from the Takshashila Institution. I'm a program manager here, and I'll be your host for today's episode. So today I have the pleasure, actually, of being joined by a guest. We actually just had a brief chat before recording this, and who's actually a little bit far away and not based in India right now. So I'm mindful of the time difference even as we're having this conversation. But not to keep, again, our listeners in suspense, my guest today is Riya Sinha, who will be joining us to talk about something really interesting, actually a topic around land connectivity, particularly in the Bay of Bengal region. So I'll just, before I do a little bit of an introduction for Riya, I'll first just say, welcome to ATP. It's a pleasure to have you here, Riya.
Thank you for inviting me to the All Things Policy podcast, Kripa. I've been following the podcast for a while, and I'm happy to be a part of it today and talk about the recently released working paper with Dr. Constantino Xavier. I look forward to the podcast.
Fantastic. Yeah, lovely to have you here. So I'll just do a brief introduction for you, Riya, just for folks who might not know some of your experience and expertise coming into this. So Riya Sinha is an associate fellow in the foreign policy and security vertical at the Center for Social and Economic Progress, where she coordinates the Sambandh Regional Connectivity Initiative, which is focused on conducting data-driven research to map India's links with its neighboring countries. In 2022, Riya was a visiting fellow at the Stimson Center in Washington, D.C. Her research interests include regional economic connectivity in South Asia, particularly in the area of trade, logistics, infrastructure, and border management. So I think we'll jump right into the conversation here today, Riya. As you already sort of foreshadowed for our listeners, we are going to be discussing a recently released working paper, which touches on a number of really interesting themes here around, you know, connectivity, around like some historical considerations around the Bay of Bengal region. And as we sort of go through this episode, I'll sort of flag to our listeners that we'll be elaborating on some of this. If it's not a topic that you might be too familiar with, prepare yourselves. You're going to learn a lot more in the next little while with us. So I'll just sort of set a little bit of context here, Riya, before I sort of invite you to answer sort of a few questions on the report as well. So really today's conversation is going to be framed around, you know, India's Act East and Neighborhood First policies. The recent report that we had flagged here was authored by Riya as well as Dr. Constantino Xavier, who argues that India's regional connectivity strategy has actually predominantly focused on the maritime domain. And this report is actually making a case for greater inland connectivity. And the rationale being that it actually provides, you know, potential for greater economic corridors around the Bay of Bengal, particularly the Bangladesh, Bhutan, India, Nepal subregion. So I'll just turn to you, Riya, with my first question here. So the report talks about, you know, the region I mentioned previously, just the sub-region, that there's this deep economic, security, and geopolitical divide in this region, but actually noting that this was not always the case. So could you maybe elaborate a little bit more, I think particularly on the economic divides, because the argument, I think, for the report is that by having greater connectivity in the region, that economic corridors would be, you know, opened up a little bit more. So yeah, just if you could give us a little bit of a sense of the history of the region, as well as, sort of opportunities that need to be, you know, leveraged in the current contemporary sort of context.
Thank you for that question, Kripa. And it's a very important question also as we talk about connectivity, and something to think about that when we talk about the Bay of Bengal region, it is a region that is much less connected today as it was compared to, say, the mid-20th century, around the 1950s or 60s. Countries like Nepal, Bhutan, Bangladesh, India's northeastern region as well, used to have strong links with Burma and Southeast Asia. And these links were across a range of sectors. Transportation, for example, there were air linkages between Burma and various Indian cities in terms of trade linkages, education connectivity. Kolkata and Yangon, in fact, as we mentioned in the paper also, were historical regional hubs. However, later, both India and the neighboring countries neglected this connectivity due to various reasons. They range from political, security, economic. And as a result, what we see today is low intra-regional economic integration, where in South Asia, World Bank report states that it stands at 5%. But even in the Bay of Bengal region, it hovers around the same figure when we look at all the Bay of Bengal countries. And countries in this region, even though they have expressed openness to trade, they continue to impose ad hoc barriers. For example, the South Asian Free Trade Agreement, for example, under the SAARC umbrella, even though there is a tariff liberalization scheme, countries continue to maintain something called a negative list, wherein goods cannot be traded at all, and a sensitive list, where limited number of goods can be traded or there are goods with higher tariffs. Other barriers include infrastructure deficits, high logistics costs, high regulatory requirements. And this is also because economic similarities exist in the region. We delve into many such examples in our paper on how asymmetry in the region have led to high protectionist measures. In fact, trade deficit by itself may not be such a big issue when looked at it in the economic terms, but it is often used as a political tool by various countries in the region to restrict trade. Therefore, in order to improve economic connectivity in the region, there's a holistic approach required that addresses both tariff and non-tariff barriers. That means trade liberalization, infrastructure development, cooperation on regulatory norm, on customs procedure, trying to reduce logistics cost in the region. This is something that is going to together improve economic connectivity in this Bay of Bengal region.
Yeah, that's really helpful, I think, for us to sort of set the stage for the rest of our conversation, Ria, and just for our listeners to know really now where there are potential opportunities for us to improve some of this greater, you know, or actually lend itself to greater connectivity. I really enjoyed that the report actually outlines some suggestions of different dimensions, actually, that we need to be examining closer that might have the potential to bridge some of these divides, right? And I get excited when I hear about solutions that are being proposed. And I'm sure our listeners also are keen to hear, you know, knowing that there are some these gaps, how can we plug some of it? So your report does talk about, you know, four dimensions of inland connectivity to bridge some of these divides. And essentially you classify them as hard and, you know, air quotes, I'm putting in hard dimensions of connectivity. So those that were outlined were road linkages, rail connectivity, and land and dry ports. So would you be able to maybe elaborate on each of these hard dimensions and what some of the implications would be to explore each of these in the region?
Certainly. Thanks, Kripa. As you mentioned, this the objective of this research paper was really to provide solutions because there's a significant amount of literature that highlights the challenges. But what Dr. Xavier and I wanted to do in this particular paper was to give options and give sort of recommendations for acting on some of these challenges that can improve land connectivity in this between South and Southeast Asia. And one of the ways that can be done is through addressing the challenges in the hard infrastructure space, which we divide into road, railways, land ports, and dry ports. And all four of these collectively are essential for efficient land transportation in the region. Road, for example, it's the dominant form of cross-border movement. Almost 70% of movement, cross-border movement of trucks and passengers takes place through road. This is also an area where road improvement projects face high delays. India-Nepal border roads projects is an example in this, where it took almost 5 years, where the project was actually delayed by 5 years. And roads are also something that lead to land ports, which I'll come to in a bit. Without good quality roads, the borders will remain congested. Two our most important land ports, such as Raxaul with Nepal and Petropole in West Bengal with Bangladesh, the roads remain narrow and congested and in not a very good condition. And there's also a case if a road may be good on the Indian side, it may not be the same case that the road is good. The road is equally in the same standard and the same condition on the other side of the border. So those kind of challenges also need to be factored in. Railways as well. Railways can help overcome challenges in road connectivity. There has been so much literature that talks about the potential of railways, One rake, in fact, can carry approximately 120 to 150 trucks. It leads to lower logistics costs, and it is also a greener mode of transportation. Yet, the development of railway links in the region is lacking. And I say this because even though we have revived 6 out of 7 railway lines with Bangladesh that were existent pre-1965, there's the first passenger train with Nepal right now. The frequency of railway movement remains low, and traders usually prefer to use roads as a means of transport. Railways have still not reached the border with Myanmar, even though there is a focus on railway development in the northeastern region. But the talks about connecting India to Myanmar via railways have been on forever, and even more recently since 2005. So there is a lot of work that needs to be done for this land connectivity infrastructure. The land posts that we talk about in the paper, or integrated check posts as they are synonymously called, they play an integral role in cross-border connectivity. They streamline trade and passenger movement because both of these operations happen in a single sanitized area. And therefore, it improves efficiency of cross-border movement. Now, the issue here is that on the Indian side, because India has focused on developing these land ports through a body called the Land Ports Authority of India, we actually have very well-developed land ports. The road connectivity to the land port may be an issue, but the land port by itself functions very well with customs, immigration, warehousing space, protective agencies within the ICP monitoring the movement. However, except Nepal, where India has built land ports on a grant basis, there are no similar standard land ports on any other side of the border. Bangladesh is trying to improve its land ports, but that will still take some time. And therefore, even if there is no problem on the Indian side of the border for the land ports, there is a problem on the other side of the border. And this is not a railway or air link. You know, when once you're out of the country, you're out, you're just literally going across the border, and that's going to impact your logistics costs significantly. The fourth infrastructure that we talk about in the paper are the dry ports. And these are lesser talked about when we speak about land connectivity. And they're more relevant for sea connectivity, but they do hold immense potential for land connectivity movement. These are inland ports where, you know, they are cargo aggregation points from where trucks and railways can take cargo up to sea ports, to land ports, any of the designated ports. However, there are not enough dry ports or even something called multimodal logistics park, which the name itself suggests that it's a multi-transportation mode logistics park, to not only decongest the land border, but also improve trade through the region. We need more of them, especially in India's northeast region. These dry ports need to be recognized as ports of entry and exit in trade and transit agreements, which currently they're not. As a result, the land ports are congested because suppose if an exporter from Bangladesh is sending goods, the end port is usually, say, Petrapol land port. It's not a dry port inland. If it's a dry port inland, that's going to decongest our borders. Right now, trucks have a very high waiting time and turnaround time at the borders. And therefore, we propose that there is a need to recognize dry ports as ports of entry or exit in various bilateral trade and transit agreements.
Oh, that's really interesting. I have a few follow-up questions, I think, from that, Ria. So I think the first, I'm curious, do you think that there have, in fact, been, you know, agreements that do a good job? Or do you have examples of agreements that have done a good job sort of recognizing ports as part of the dialogue on trade?
So we have standard trade and transit agreements that recognize a certain number of ports as points of entry and exit. India-Nepal has that agreement, and India-Bangladesh also have that agreement. India-Nepal, if I'm not wrong, it's about 24 or 27 points that are recognized as points of entry and exit, and they are all border points. They're not any of the inland points. Similarly, with Bangladesh, although we have about 54 land crossing points, which are called land custom stations or immigration checkposts or ICPs. Collectively, they are about 54 in number. They're again border points. They are not inland at all. That's why we propose that dry ports need to be recognized at points of entry or exit.
And examples, I think, outside of sort of the region that come to mind, beyond maybe just in India, that you can cite as examples, if anything comes to mind. But I was just curious to know if...
I mean, we don't really need to go outside India for that matter. For example, seaports. When goods come to a seaport, if a container is coming to the Jawaharlal, the Nava Sheva port in Navi Mumbai, It's not the JNPT ports that recognize it a port of entry or exit. It's the ICD, it's the dry port in Tughlakabad that is the port of exit. So the whole transportation corridor is covered and you're not congesting the seaports. But the same logic is not applied to land ports. So we really don't need to go across the border to see that there is a disparity in practices across different modes of transportation.
I think that makes sense. I think another question I had was about maybe it is putting you in a bit of a tough spot. So, but, you know, just to hear your sort of thoughts on it personally, you know, if you had to prioritize, you know, of the four dimensions that you've mentioned, what would you think, or even if you want to categorize it as, you know, something that would be a short-term versus medium versus long-term endeavor, what would be the sequence perhaps in which you would pursue each of these dimensions?
If I want to prioritize development of a particular mode, I would really want a lot more emphasis on railway development in the region and not just cross-border railway, not just India-Bangladesh, not just India-Nepal, but actually a regional railway development. Because globally, you know, globally railways are used much more efficiently compared to within this region where, like I said, 70% of the transportation takes place via road. Whereas in Western countries and European countries, the figure is actually reversed. 60 to 70% takes place via rail and the rest by road. Rail has a lot of potential because A, one rail can carry a lot of cargo. Second, railways also have a flexibility of use in the sense we can get ro-ro wagons where a truck can get on a railway wagon and then disembark in a neighboring country to deliver cargo at the final location. So the potential of using railways for multimodal transportation is actually much more, and it's a much more efficient mode than the others. And it also leads to dry port connectivity because railways would leave from one dry port to another dry port, say, in the neighboring countries. And then the last mile connectivity issue is also sorted with the truck movement, with the ro-ro truck movement. So railways has a lot of potential in the region. I mean, that to answer if I want to prioritize something. But there's another factor here that what we need to develop is in this region and something that's done in ASEAN also is the concept of economic corridors, where certain land corridors are identified. And on those land corridors, infrastructure is good. Customs procedures have been streamlined. Traffic regulations have been streamlined so that there is nonstop movement of truck. Right now, if a truck comes, there are formal and informal practices that we need to account for in cross-border movement, unfortunately, today, which does increase the logistics cost. There have been interventions to address these challenges. A lot of improvements have also taken place, but there's a lot more still to be done.
Thank you for sort of sorting through how you would possibly characterize or even categorize some of it, because I think it seems like an ambitious task to take up, right? So just to give a sense of if we were in a position of having to prioritize just the one, I think you make a really good case that rail is something that needs to be prioritized first and foremost. So I'm going to make a sort of maybe a transition here from, you know, we focus now on the hard dimensions of what inland connectivity, excuse me, could look like. But your paper, I really enjoyed that it actually talks about soft dimensions of connectivity as well, that beyond just the more, you know, instinctively we might think of, you know, infrastructural investments that might be the only component of this, but talking about the soft dimensions of sort of creating an enabling environment for some of these factors to become a reality. I really appreciated that, I think, about the report. So just for our listeners who might not be aware, you know, the paper has five soft dimensions of connectivity that are highlighted. So I'll just sort of list them out so we're all on the same page. So the first was that there's a recommendation for institutional capacity for coordinating connectivity initiatives between central and state levels. So I think that's a really important point, recognizing, you know, jurisdictional considerations there. Second, you know, instruments to support cross-border stability and security is an important factor. The third is, you know, recommendation of new international partnerships, especially with regional organizations and multilat institutions. The fourth is closer regional collaboration, on infrastructure norms and standards. And the fifth is increased engagement with the private sector. So there are a lot of different threads, I'm sure, that could be pulled to sort of examine this, right? Because there's so much to unpack over here, Ria. But I think I'll just focus some of our listeners' attention on partnerships, because I think, you know, the potential of collaboration and then, you know, arguably every one of these recommendations has a thematic, you know, connection on partnerships being such a key aspect of it. It cannot just be a, you know, an endeavor taken up solely by just one actor. But I'm going to focus on maybe the international partnerships with, you know, regional and multilateral organizations. So maybe in that regard, could you maybe highlight some of India's, you know, current regional connectivity and infrastructural partnerships, and where you anticipate that there's actually some more room to grow? And then maybe, you know, as a to tag onto that, a second question, you know, how would you sort of recommend that India's approach be to these types of partnerships? Should there be a bit of a slightly passive and reactive approach to it? Because I can see value in something like that, or something, you know, really proactive and sort of setting a tone on what some of these partnerships should look like.
One thing that we need to appreciate in today's India is that, you know, today New Delhi, in fact, is much more open to connectivity partnership than, say, in the 20th century, whether it's through regional institutions, through bilateral partnerships, through multilateral institutions, particularly in its neighborhood today. And these are really, these partnerships are essential for not just project delivery, for project implementation, but also for political trust building. Some of the examples that come to my mind, that India is a part of the Asian Development Bank's SASEC program, the South Asian Subregional Economic Cooperation Program for multimodal transport connectivity. India is also part of initiatives such as the Bangladesh, Bhutan, India-Nepal framework, which has been moving forward, albeit a little slowly, on the Motor Vehicles Agreement. At a regional level, BIMSTEC is an important regional organization that India has been a part of. The current Secretary General is from India, and Bangladesh is up for the next chairmanship. And this also highlights that perhaps there is a potential now to implement the BIMSTEC master plan for transport connectivity. India has been engaged in all of these various forums at different levels, giving inputs on connectivity through its, you know, years of work in this area. You know, one of the seminal reports of India would be the India Transport Report of 2014, which every connectivity and transport researcher has to read to get into this area. But coming back to your question, at a bilateral level, I think the partnerships have also been developing, and this is a different story that we see today. US, for example, has supported a transmission line between Nepal and India. Japan, in fact, has emerged as a preferred partner for development projects in the Northeast region and Bangladesh. And I was recently in Shillong in a trilateral dialogue organized by the Asian Confluence. And it was really good to see. I've been in this area for 9 years, but I've not seen so much Japanese participation. There were it was in the Northeast region. MEA was involved. The border states were involved. It was organized by Asian Confluence. But the involvement of the Japanese, there were at least 30 plus Japanese businessmen present in Shillong for this dialogue to highlight, you know, the potential for connectivity between Bangladesh and the Northeast region. That is the kind of interest being generated today through different levels of partnerships. Now, the next step that India needs to do is deepen this partnership with the existing players, as well as many more other players engaged in the region. Now, one of the difficult areas for India's connectivity between South and Southeast Asia is dealing with Myanmar. India has been dealing with Myanmar at a bilateral level, but connectivity projects require a little bit more of partnership. And in that, I think Thailand is a particularly important actor because it has remained engaged with Myanmar even after the 2021 military coup and can play a role as a facilitator for key projects, including the, you know, the India-Myanmar-Thailand Trilateral Highway, which is an important project for India. So my recommendation would be to really deepen the connectivity partnerships with as many number of players in the region, including the European Union, including Australia, because this is an area that is growing economically. It's a geostrategically, geoeconomically important area, and players are going to be interested in the region, and it will be in India's interest to cooperate with many of these players.
Yeah, thank you. It's a very comprehensive response, Ria. And just to flag for those who might not be familiar with the acronym BIMSTEC, that's the Bay of Bengal Initiative for Multisectoral Technical and Economic Cooperation, correct? And how would you sort of describe the regional organization BIMSTEC?
So BIMSTEC is a regional organization of the Bay of Bengal countries. It used to be a very sector-based organization. Earlier, it was formed in 1997, and then it was a sector-based organization in the sense that there were 14 sectors for countries to work together, which has thankfully now been reduced to 7, just for more efficiency purposes. But for many years, BIMSTEC was not really functional, if I may use the word, or it was not very efficient or forthcoming in its initiatives. But in the last few years, also a lot because of India's push and trying to move away from SAARC, BIMSTEC has gained new momentum. The secretariat at Dhaka has an improved capacity compared to, say, you know, 5 or even 10 years ago. A charter has been adopted in the last BIMSTEC summit, and a lot more movement on the initiatives is taking place. So BIMSTEC is an organization that is not just important for the region, but it is something that external players in the region like Australia are very much interested in.
That's actually really useful to know. I think even just framing some of the potential, you know, partnerships that might be brewing in that regional organization as well. So, you know, we're almost done with our episode here today, and there are a number of questions that I'm going to shelf, I think, because a lot of what you've shared, I think, is really interesting to unpack. And of course, I would recommend that all those listening today take the opportunity to explore this report in detail, which does a really good job of laying out some of these considerations. And does probably better justice than, you know, a half hour discussion on it. So as we wrap up here, Ria, you'll have to forgive me for using a bit of a pun. We've covered a lot of ground today, but I'm going to ask that you do the hard task of summarizing maybe, you know, if there were three things that you wanted to highlight for a listener who sort of sat with us through this episode today, what would be the three key sort of takeaways or the most important things you'd like to bring to their attention?
You know, when you write a 13,000 word paper, it's very difficult to summarize things into three brief key takeaways, but I'll try to do this. I think the first important takeaway would be the gist of the paper that this region, this Bay of Bengal region, India's neighborhood, in fact, cannot be fully connected, cannot harness the economic dividends unless and until multimodal connectivity initiatives complement the maritime connectivity initiatives. Nothing can work in isolation. We have been an historically connected region, both through land and maritime. And for continued economic prosperity, it is important that both modes are complementary to each other. And the second thing is addressing the challenges now in land connectivity would require both hard infrastructure development solutions, as well as softer infrastructure, as well as institutional interventions that we mentioned in the report. No country today can do this alone, and India also cannot do this alone. That's why it is important to work with like-minded partners to fulfill the connectivity objectives. And finally, a very important point in the paper is that India's northeastern region is currently its biggest economic development opportunity. If the northeastern region can be positioned as a transportation hub for the Bay of Bengal region, there will be immense growth due to the economic opportunities coming in. And India really needs to leverage this as part of its Act East policy.
No, I think those are three sort of fantastic areas to land on, even as we conclude, Naria. Yeah, I think you couldn't have sort of stressed the point better. And I'm hoping that it inspires, our listeners to take the opportunity to do a bit of a deep dive in the region, because it's true that it might be something that doesn't typically catch, headline attentions instinctively for a lot of folks. So it might be displaced as a consideration when, some other factors might be coming up. So I'm really happy that we have the opportunity to highlight it here today as well, right? So I'm going to wrap us up today. I want to give you a big thank you for your time, for your expertise, for recording this as well at, I know it's a later hour for you as well, but thank you so much for joining us here today. An absolute pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much, Kripa. It's been an absolute pleasure to be on the All Things Policy podcast, and I'll continue to listening to your forthcoming episodes.
Thank you, Ria. And to our listeners, please stay tuned for the next episode that's coming right up.
If you liked our show, dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs. Check us out at our Twitter handle at takshashilainst or our website takshashila.org.in.